This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Can one person really change the world? Dr. Paul Farmer is making the case that all of us have that potential. Farmer is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he chairs the Department of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He won a MacArthur Genius Award for creating a public health system in Conj, Haiti, in the midst of a squatter settlement devastated by poverty and disease. Through his foundation, Partners in Health, he and his colleagues are providing not only basic medical care to nearly a million Haitians, they've also built schools and water sanitation systems and accomplished things many have claimed were impossible in impoverished communities, like successfully treating drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis and reducing the incidence of HIV. Working with governmental agencies and international organizations like the WHO, Farmer has pursued similar programs in Peru, Russia, and in Boston, Massachusetts. He's the subject of a new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, by Tracy Kidder. Farmer first came to Haiti when he was 23, after studying for a degree in medical anthropology. I asked him what he saw there that made him want to start his own rural hospital.
If you go to a hospital and you need, say, for example, you have obstructed labor, that is, you're at your due date, you're pregnant, you're at your due date, the baby doesn't come out. And if you have $700, you can have a cesarean section, and if you don't have $700, you don't receive appropriate medical care. And I had seen this happen in a couple of the clinics and facilities, hospitals that I visited in Haiti, and I thought it would be intolerable to work in those conditions. And, you know, illness after illness, I mention obstructed labor because that was something that hit me early on. You know, it hadn't occurred to me really at the age of 23 or 24 that, you know, your social standing would determine whether or not you survived pregnancy.
So could you describe for us then the scope of the medical services that the complex provides that's funded by your charity group Partners in Health?
Well, you know, it's actually a very ambitious endeavor now. There's 104 beds, there are two operating rooms, there's a dental clinic, an ophthalmology clinic, a women's health clinic. We have an HIV and TB clinic, probably the first AIDS treatment program in a really poor country. All in one very concentrated campus. I suppose it's utopian or maybe impossible to have a Brigham and Women's Hospital in the middle of a squatter settlement in central Haiti, but it's a pretty good, you know, dream to aspire to. And so that was the goal. But of course you start with an idea like that and soon you find out that the children that you're taking good care of for their complex diseases, they're also not in school. Or you see the 1,000th case of typhoid and you know that that's because people don't have clean drinking water. Or you see a whole family living in a very tiny hut, all with tuberculosis, and realize that, of course, not only do they not have access to care for tuberculosis, they also don't have adequate housing. So it sort of opens a Pandora's box. Once you start doing a good job taking care of taking care of sick people, which is what a doctor or a nurse does, and become involved in their lives and visit them at home, you discover that they're not just sick. They're facing what seem to some to be insuperable problems. I personally don't believe they're insuperable problems, and neither do my many coworkers and colleagues in Haiti, most of whom are Haitian. We believe they're problems that can be addressed with the right kind of conviction and resources.
So, what kind of money does it take to make this work? And do you charge patients for treatment?
It takes very little money to make this sort of thing work. Just to give a specific example. There was finally a study of how much it cost to take care of a patient with tuberculosis in the city of Chicago. And this is just regular tuberculosis because, you know, we've worked with very complicated forms of tuberculosis that are difficult and expensive to treat. But if you added up hospitalization costs in special kind of rooms that TB patients go into in a U.S. hospital, and the care provided by doctors and nurses in the public health department, they came up with a figure of $68,000 per patient per cure. And we provide excellent care for tuberculosis in rural Haiti with community-based care, and in which a community health worker visits the patient every day. And we have cure rates that are even better than many posted in American cities, and we can do that for under $200. So I think that it doesn't cost a lot to do a good job.
How is that possible, though? How do you keep costs down?
Well, for one thing, we rely on community health workers to do the everyday work. I mean, that's what we did when we decided, when we became the first clinic in Haiti to decide, well, many are arguing that it's not cost-effective or even possible to treat AIDS in a country this poor. And we had already decided that we weren't going to listen to that sort of logic because our mandate is to remediate inequalities of access to care, that is to take care of the destitute sick. So we already had a mandate that we worked hard to develop. So when AIDS came along to rural Haiti, we felt impelled to try and introduce the same standard of care, or maybe even better, than what you'd get in Boston. And the way it became possible is because we'd already learned from our experience at delivering prenatal care or tuberculosis care to use community health workers. And, you know, community health workers are not volunteers, but the labor costs in Haiti are very low. And there's enormous interest among villagers to become trained as community health workers or village health workers. And that's one of the reasons that, A, our costs are low, and B, our outcomes are excellent. That is, these people do a very good job delivering care.
Well, I want to talk about some of the other changes you've made in your program or improvements you've made in your program that other hospitals don't pursue or other international medical projects don't pursue. And one of them is you travel to see patients when they don't come in for treatment, your aid workers at the hospital. And also when you travel to Haiti, you also do this. And you'll travel hours walking through into the mountains to track patients down to make sure that they get their treatment. And this is a rule at your hospital. Why?
Well, we had this traumatic experience in 1988, which is 15 years ago. And we had the clinic had been founded 3 years earlier. And we don't pay for tuberculosis medications. The Haitian government, the Ministry of Health, provides us these medications. And so, as in most countries, in principle, and we thought in our own clinic, that TB care, tuberculosis care, was free. Well, in 1988, three people from right around the clinic died of tuberculosis. And that was a very traumatic experience for me, at that time we had only one doctor, and for the community health workers on whom we relied. And there were several nurses at the time. And we got together and said, what happened here? How could we lose three otherwise healthy young people, parents with kids, how could we lose them to this eminently treatable disease? And it was interesting. There were all these discrepant theories as to what had happened. And some people, and it was really mostly the professionals, they tended to blame the patients. And they brought up this whole idea of, you know, they believe in voodoo and they're superstitious and that's why they die of tuberculosis, even though they have free care. But the community health workers who shared the social conditions of the patients who died, they didn't agree, by and large. They said, no, these are the poorest patients who died. And when we started looking harder that year at our so-called free TB treatment program, we found all kinds of hidden costs. For example, we found that it costs money to get to the clinic if you were too sick to walk. And even if you could walk, you know, for 3 hours, you're not doing something else. If you're a peasant farmer, you're not planting, you're not hoeing. But for people who couldn't walk, they had to pay to borrow a donkey. And then we found that, you know, at that time we were using a drug called streptomycin. It's not used as widely anymore. It's a good TB drug, but you have to give it as an injection. And we found out that they were paying people to give them the injection in the village. And so what we did is we just eradicated every single barrier to free care, and then we felt we could have an honest conversation. But only after we made the care really free to the patient could we have an honest discussion as to why these people died. And so I have to say, you know, since that time, since we overhauled the project, we haven't lost patients to tuberculosis.
Why do you, though, do that kind of work? Why are you doing hands-on work in the clinic now and visiting patients in faraway regions? I would think your time is very short. You have this huge project that you help administer and fundraise for.
Well, I do it because I like it. It's my favorite part of the work, the clinical work and visiting patients in their homes, or really, they're not homes, they're huts. But and as you said, we get some of our best ideas by walking a long way and thinking about what patients must be going through. If I could give you one example, I remember the day distinctly that I ran into a patient who had a child on her arm. And she had, the child, I think, was about 3. And she had come from the clinic. And I offered, because she looked so, the woman had looked sick herself and the child was sick. And she had not been seen at the clinic. She'd brought her kid there. And I said, can I help you carry the baby? And she threw me this look, first of all, incredulous and then grateful. And after, and it was a 3-hour hike to her home village, and after a half an hour of carrying this 3-year-old, who was a malnourished child, my arm started to hurt. And after an hour of carrying that child, my arm was really killing me. And so, you know, I being not sick, I did make it all the way to that village the rest of the way with the kid on my arm. And I sat down and I was fanning myself with a piece of paper I had, and I said to her, well, you know, my arm hurts from carrying that child, from carrying your baby. Doesn't it hurt your arm? And she said, if I go to your clinic with one of my infants, my arm hurts for weeks afterwards. And, you know, it had never occurred to me before. I never thought about it. And I can think about all these things I learn from, you know, on the way to these villages that are obviously very far away from the fundraising or the international conferences or the work that is regarded as really important by some. But I think you do learn things by sticking close to the patients and their conditions.
Part of the problem in fighting many of these epidemics, AIDS, also TB, is that the drugs are very expensive. You've had some success getting drug companies to lower the price of drugs in order to implement your projects. How do you do that? Sounds impossible.
Well, you know, there's all sorts of different tricks, I might say, and some of it is cajoling, and sometimes it's working with individuals within these big companies who are sympathetic to the cause. Sometimes it's working with generic manufacturers in other countries. But the fact remains that I think it was the Indian Minister of Health who said once said in term reference to AIDS drugs, if you can drop the prices by 80%, it suggests that there was something wrong with the initial price setting to start with. And I think that's true. You know, the TB drugs had been off patent for years. There's no reason that they should have cost that much. And we proved that you could drop the drug prices by 95% with most of them.
Well, you were working on this project before you were able to negotiate lower prices for these drugs, and there is a story that Tracy Kidder tells in the book about you, in which it involves you and a colleague borrowing drugs from the hospital that you work in Boston. Can you tell me about that?
What, are you trying to get me fired?
Well, $92,000
no.
worth of drugs.
Well, we just borrowed it. No, the colleague that you're talking about is Jim Kim, and we were working in a hospital that had these drugs on hand, but didn't have the patients. The patients were in Peru, and so we were borrowing the drugs.
Yeah, how did that work? Did you have friends in the pharmacy,
yes,
and they would
we promised to pay back the pharmacy. I'm not sure we had a very clear strategy at the time, but when the president of the hospital he asked about this, and then also his successor did too. Our biggest supporter, a man named Tom White, came and bailed us out, and paid off our debts to the pharmacy. But, and you know, again, the thing that makes me uncomfortable about the story is that it does make it sound like extraordinary measures are required to stop an epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis, when in fact I think what's required is political will. I mean, why should, you know, one of these drugs, a gram, which is a day's supply, cost $29 at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and, you know, you could find it for $8 in Paris, made, you know, by the same company. So, you know, we tried buying it in Paris. There were enough patients, and this is a disease that takes a long time to treat. Our patients were poor. They weren't going to be able to pay for these drugs. And we were trying to find ways of making sure that they never missed a dose. And they didn't miss a dose.
I want to ask you about some of the arguments that are offered against offering medical aid and international support for large-scale projects that combat infectious diseases. And one of them is that cultural differences will make it problematic to properly treat patients. And that was part of the bias against funding drug treatment to HIV patients in Africa. How does religion or cultural mores enter into the work that you do? And I'm thinking many Haitians believe in voodoo or sorcery and seek other treatments for disease.
Well, you know, this is one of those instances in which it was really helpful to not to have training in anthropology, to have a doctoral degree in anthropology, but to be able to say, that's not true, and I'm also an anthropologist. Because really, the arguments that cultural beliefs or religious beliefs will serve as barriers to effective care are, this is perhaps not a very scholarly term, but they're just bogus. There's no evidence, really, to show that that's what the barrier to care is. And frankly, I really don't believe that is why we can't treat AIDS in Africa. I believe we can't treat AIDS in Africa because powerful people, decision makers, still don't have the political will that we need in order to move even community health, to pay community health workers. We don't need big infrastructures to treat AIDS, or tuberculosis for that matter, or drug-resistant malaria. What we need are the medicines and the community health workers, and make sure that the community health workers are paid at least a modest stipend so that they can do this job and not another job, like such as planting corn or millet for their family to eat.
Is it possible to have political will at the level it would require to be effective to institute these changes?
Well, you know, hope springs eternal, but that means Washington, Tokyo, Paris, Munich, Geneva. I think the political will we need is in the rich countries and in, I mean, for example, this is pretty dull stuff, but the international financial institutions like the World Bank. I mean, the World Bank is the leading funder of TB control, and what they decide, what kind of TB gets treated, how it's done, that lays down the law for most of these poorer countries. So that's where the political will needs to be summoned.
There's something very interesting, a quote in the book. You say, you've organized your life around areas of moral clarity. Can you talk about what you mean by moral clarity?
Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of things in a book like that you wish you'd never said.
I'm sure I'll hit on everyone.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, when you spend, the way that the author of that book works is he just hangs around with you so long that you basically tell him anything he wants to hear. And so, you know, when you talk about areas of moral clarity, I don't know, maybe it sounds a little sophomoric, but I feel that when you're a physician or, again, a nurse, and you know the answer to a problem, a patient's problem, that it's a good thing to act and save lives or prevent suffering. And so in some ways, maybe that's a cop-out answer. That is, people who are trained as healers, who are around the sick, they should have plenty of areas of moral clarity. But as you point out, things are very complicated in the doing, and you know, the devil's in the details. We made errors along the way, and we're going to make errors, I'm sure, in the future. But it seems like if you could have more successes than make errors in a world so fraught with problems and riven by social inequality, that you might be on the right track. And I don't know if I'd push it much farther than that, because then it'll sound like I've you know, have happened on some great solutions and know the answers to lots of problems that I don't know the answers to.
Well, it's a real honor to talk with you, Dr. Paul Farmer. Thank you for talking.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's been a real privilege to be on the show.
Dr. Paul Farmer is the founding director of Partners in Health and the head of the Department of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's the subject of Tracy Kidder's new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains.